This lesson is entitled, Get Out Before You Strike Out. Now, we've been talking the last couple weeks about second lesson in our series on temptation. How do you handle temptation? When I was first married, Abby and I were newly married, I was beginning to discover my wife's affinity for everything Jimmy Stewart. My wife loves Jimmy Stewart, the actor from the 50s and 40s, 50s, 60s, I guess, mostly. Tall, lanky guy, everything that I'm not, you know. So I can't compare myself to him, I guess, which is a good thing. I'd probably lose. But she loves Jimmy Stewart movies, and so we went on a quest in our younger married years about everything. Let's watch all the Jimmy Stewart movies that we can. I guess she had already seen some. I had not. I had a lot of catching up to do, let's say. So we were watching lots and lots of Jimmy Stewart movies, and one of the crazy things about Jimmy Stewart, if you're a fan, by the way, how many of you love Jimmy Stewart? I mean, he's just your favorite actor of that era, right? Okay. So, did you watch that? So one of the things that's great about Jimmy Stewart is the multiple kinds of roles that he's held over his acting career. I mean, he's played everything from a farmer to an attorney to a husband, a businessman, a business owner, all these kinds of roles. And one of the roles that he plays in this movie, Anatomy of a Murder, is the role of an attorney. How many of you guys have seen this movie? It's 1959, I think, Anatomy of a Murder. We were shocked when we first watched this movie, actually, that it was made in 1959, because if you've ever seen this movie, the details of the plot are kind of racy, okay? Jimmy Stewart plays this attorney. I forgot his name here. It's James Bigler, Paul Bigler, a small-town lawyer who has lost his re-election for district attorney, okay? So he's kind of been tracking on this district attorney thing for a while. He lost his job and doesn't really have a whole lot except to return to law and pick up a few cases here and there until he gets this really big case. And this really big case is this Army veteran, Lieutenant Frederick Mannion. They call him Manny in the movie, but this guy, Manny, has been accused of murder, and it's pretty obvious that Manny did murder this guy. The problem is that Manny in the movie insists that this man that he killed raped his wife. And so there's a little bit of some racy details in the movie and the plot, and all the plot is basically trying to uncover not only the details of the murder, but actually what happened to the woman that that he was supposed to have been with. Was it consensual? Was it not consensual? And some of these kinds of details throughout the movie. One of the things that I think makes this movie so popular, not only because it has a great character as Jimmy Stewart, a great plot like it does, and some of the edge-of-your-seat kind of suspense type stuff, but that it kind of speaks to something that we, by nature, as human beings, enjoy. And it's kind of a sick, twisted thing in our character and our being of wanting to listen in on the details of someone else's private happenings and private life. I don't know, in the more modern era, if you have, gotten into the shows like CSI, of course it's no longer, but Criminal Minds, if you like those kinds of criminal detective shows, one of the things, and you guys are smiling, some of you, because you're like, oh, that's me, one of the things that we love about those shows is being able to go back and kind of unearth details about what happened in this, scenario, what happened in this situation, and actually who was it and who did it. And the Anatomy of Murder is all about what really happened. And let's go back and find out some of these details about this case. You know, one of the things about Bible stories that I love is that that's exactly what we get to do. We go back into these people's lives, especially in the Old Testament, and we get to read about them and find out exactly what happened. How did they do this? Good or bad? Was it a good thing? Should we want to repeat it? Do we want to avoid it? In fact, Paul in the New Testament will say these things have been written, talking about the Old Testament, as examples for you, so that we can learn by them. And one of the examples in one of the more sad stories in the Old Testament is this story from 2 Samuel chapter 11. And I'm not going to read the whole story. I do want to read with you the first five verses. So if you want to turn there, if you haven't already, we're going to be in the first five verses of 2 Samuel in what I would call the anatomy of an affair. This is talking about David. It says, in the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. It happened one late afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So David sent messengers, and he took her and came to her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived and sent and told David, "I am pregnant." If you're at all familiar with this story, you know kind of what happens next. And so let me recap for a little bit how the story unfolds. David is this king, very well-known king, very successful king. And he, for whatever reason, he chooses to stay home in the spring when the kings are out to battle, sees this woman, sends for her, they sleep together, she gets pregnant, and then he's got a situation on his hands. And the rest of the story, the rest of the chapter, is David trying to get out of the mess that he's created for himself. And he goes through all sorts of loops and jumps over hoops and all sorts of things to try to untangle himself from quite a mess. First, he sends and brings back her husband, Uriah, home. He was out to battle, thinking that if I can send this guy home for a night or two, maybe they'll get together, we can make it look like this is his baby, not mine, and it'll all be good. And if you read the story, you know that that doesn't happen. David sends for Uriah. He comes home, and he sends his man, Uriah, tries to send him home, but Uriah refuses to go into his house. He instead sleeps on the palace steps, saying, "I can't go home when my men are out to battle. This isn't right," showing himself an honorable man. David tries a second time. This time he gets him drunk, hoping that maybe inebriated he'll go home. Still he doesn't go home. David's out of options at this point. And so he does the unthinkable. He sends the man back into battle with what is essentially a death notice. Uriah is carrying orders that he doesn't know to be given to his general, that when they get into the next battle, Uriah is to be sent into the thick of the fighting so that it would be almost certain that he would die. And that's exactly what happens. Uriah dies in battle. David thinks the whole thing is taken care of. He takes Bathsheba, she becomes his wife, and the child is born. But God did not forget. And he sends Nathan the prophet to confront David. The next chapter is David's having to deal with this sin and the reality of what it has caused the offended parties. But what I think is so interesting is going back, what went wrong? If you kind of replay the events of the chapter and you kind of piece together bits of the story, you get to a point where David had a choice to make. And some people would say, as they read the beginning, the opening verses that we did, the problem was that David was home. It was the springtime. He should have been out to battle. He shouldn't have been at the palace. I don't know that that's really the problem. I think the problem occurs a couple verses later as he's walking along. In the rooftop of his house, of his palace, he sees a woman. Now, there's really nothing wrong about walking along the rooftop as he probably would have done that afternoon. It was a common thing in those days. When you had a house that got hot in the day, the rooftop was meant for people to get away from the heat of the house. And so, in the afternoon, when it was the hottest, it wasn't uncommon to go on the rooftop and get relief from the heat. And so, that's exactly what David's doing. He's walking around on this rooftop. He sees a woman. Again, no problem. He can't help the fact that he's walking around on the rooftop. He can't help the fact that he sees something, right? It's a part of life. We see things that we shouldn't. And yet, it's what happens next that is the problem. As David sins, and it says that he inquired about the woman. Who is this woman? Obviously, on David's part, there's a little curiosity with this. She's attractive. She's naked, beautiful. Who is this woman? And it's interesting and telling at the same time what someone says. It's not clear who says this, but somebody even throws a red flag up and says, isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? In other words, David, this is somebody's wife. This is a problem. This is somebody, in fact, it's not just anybody, it's Uriah's wife. If you go back and you read David's story, before he became king, he had a group of about 30 men, mighty men he calls them, that followed him around and protected him and helped him when he was running from Saul. The king Saul was trying to kill him. One of those men was Uriah. This was not just any soldier. This was not just any general. This was one of the most trusted people that David held so close to him in those crucial years before becoming king. This was one of his mighty men. And he says, no, isn't this Uriah the Hittite's wife? And still, David sends for the woman, and she comes to him. They sleep together. She gets pregnant, and the cover-up ensues. And I would say to you from this passage and from others that we can look at in Scripture, our sin has deadly consequences. I think you can see that. But covering up our sin is even more deadly. Sometimes in an effort to try to manage the damage that we've created in our life, when we're not being honest with ourselves, with other people that we've offended, and the wrong that we've ultimately done, when we try to cover up what we've already done, things get even more sticky. Things get even more messy. And we create a bigger scenario than we had originally intended. Imagine for a moment if David had not sent Uriah into battle the way he did. If he had not tried to cover up the sin in the way that he had done, somebody would still be alive. Some woman would still have her husband. Some father would, or some son or daughter would still have their father. And here's the other thing about this story and what actually happened with David. David is walking along the top of his roof. He sees something, right? And it's not until we see David pursuing it that we see an issue. You are not responsible for what you see or hear. You are responsible for what you do with what you see or hear. It's hard in a culture as sin-soaked as ours, in the world that we live in, to walk as people in the world and not see, not hear, not become an observer of something immoral. And it's at that moment where we have a decision to make, as David did. What am I going to do with what I've seen, what I've heard? And you go back and you think, what could David have done differently? What could he have, if he had rewound the tape, replayed it, what could he have stopped himself from doing and done instead that would have prevented all this from happening? Well, there's another man, in another story, who did what David should have done and didn't. In Genesis 39, if you want to turn there, go ahead. If not, you can follow along and listen. But Genesis 39 tells the story of another individual who finds himself, again, in one of those situations where there's no wrong having done on his part. He's just there. This is Genesis 39. I'm going to start and read actually just a few verses here in the middle of the story and start in about verse 6. Now, to get back kind of some background information, this is Joseph. This is the story of Joseph and his interactions with Potiphar's wife. Joseph had been sold as a slave by his brothers into slavery, who eventually brought him down to Egypt. He finds himself basically at the bottom, works his way up into the household of Potiphar. Potiphar is one of Pharaoh's trusted generals. And basically, Joseph has worked himself from the bottom of a slave all the way up as high as you could go in Potiphar's house, to the point that he managed the whole household. Very successful as a slave to be able to be in a position like that, or a lot of responsibility. And in fact, we know from what is said about Joseph and what Joseph says about his own job that Potiphar basically was a hands-off kind of a boss. He ran the place. He trusted everything to Joseph. But look what the interaction is between Joseph and Potiphar's wife. This is verse 6 of the second half. It says, "Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has under my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her or to be with her. But one day, when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house were there, she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house." Again, let's go back. Let's look at the story a little bit. Joseph is a slave in the house of Potiphar. Nothing he can do about it. He was handsome in form and appearance. There's nothing he can do about the way he looks. He's naturally attractive. And even the fact that Potiphar's wife desires him, she persistently is after him, to lie with me. Joseph can do nothing about that either. He's kind of stuck. But one day, when there's nobody in the house, something happens. And now Joseph can do something, and he does. She catches him by the garment, thinking nobody's going to be around to see this, and almost forcibly starts with it again, "Lie with me." And his solution is to worm himself out of his coat, leave it there in her hands, and run out of the house. Why did Joseph leave? I think we could look at it a couple different ways, but to be honest with you, I think Joseph left because he had his own desires as a man. Okay? I don't think Joseph was in danger of being forcibly to do anything that he wouldn't want to do. I don't think he was in danger of being raped. I don't think he was in danger of any of that. I think Joseph knew that, hey, I'm a guy. I have desires. This woman is here. Nobody's around. Nobody don't know. I got to get out of here. Or I'm going to do something that I'll regret for the rest of my life. And so he runs away. Joseph's fear wasn't rape. It was his lust. Last week we talked about, from James chapter 1, about temptation and how it kind of works. And we looked at how it's from our own desire that we're tempted, we're lured away and enticed and tempted to sin. And sin, when it's fully formed, brings forth death. And we talked about how it's important in the battle against temptation to know your desire. Know what it is, uniquely you, that tempts you. Maybe it's not anything else that anybody else would enjoy or participate in, but for you, it's appealing. And you have to know it before you do anything else to fight it. But it's not just knowing it, it's avoiding it. Once you know what it is, you have to avoid it. Don't go anywhere near it. And from our passage that was read this morning, Paul tells Timothy, flee youthful passions, right? Get out of the house. Don't stay around to figure out what it is. Leave. The problem is that we don't want to, often, if we're honest, totally avoid it. There's a little bit about whatever it is that gets us, that's attractive, that's enticing, that makes us curious for more, that speaks to something maybe deep inside of ourselves that pulls us in, and we want to stay around a little bit. If nothing else, we tell ourselves, I just want to figure this out. I want to see if it really is what it seems to be. And we lie to ourselves. Maybe there's too many other good things about whatever it is. Maybe there's other things tied in with whatever the temptation is for us that aren't by themselves bad. Maybe they're actually good and beneficial and helpful in other ways, but yet they're tied to this sin, this temptation that I have. And so because of that, I stay involved, I stay too long in the scenario, and I find myself eventually falling into whatever it is. I was working with a young man one time, and a couple other things involved with this situation, but one of the issues was that he was struggling with pornography. And we were trying to, we'd set up accountability with each other, and we were meeting regularly to deal with this. And after several times of meeting, it became clear to me the problem was the phone. And this is a pretty new, you know, phenomenon for us to have to deal with stuff that's in our pocket all the time. Used to be, and I used to laugh because when I was, you know, in high school, my dad would say, it used to be you had to go to the corner of the bookstore on the top shelf and ask for it underneath the cover, right? You know? There was shame involved. You had to ask for it. Now it's at your fingertips. It was a computer when I was growing up. Now it's a phone. It's in your pocket. It's not just in your basement. It's not just in your living room. It's in your clothes. And so it became obvious with this young man that it was his phone that was the problem. And I just looked at him eventually and I said, you have to do something with the phone. I don't know what it is. I'm not suggesting anything specific. But if you don't deal with the phone, then you won't deal with the problem. And sad to say, there was too much other stuff tied into this, right? There was friends and social media and texting and calling and entertainment, and there were too many other good things that by themselves, hey, they're great. There's nothing wrong with Facebook. There's nothing wrong with texting a friend and getting together or keeping a calendar or any of the other things that we do with our phone, but because it became a problem, it's too hard to untangle. As long as you continue to interact with your temptation, you will interact with your sin. And I know it's hard sometimes because we tell ourselves, yes, but I have so many other things. It's not just this. It's, if I get rid of this, then it's also this and this and this and this. Yes, but how badly do you want it? Because on one hand, what we tell ourselves is, I want to be free from this, whatever this is for you. I want to be free from this. But on the other hand, I'm not willing to give up whatever it is that it's going to take for me to get free from this temptation, this sin. And until you're willing to get rid of the temptation, you will always struggle with the sin. You know what they say? Play with fire, you get burned. Get too close to the edge, you fall in, right? And so if I'm being honest with myself, and we talked about honesty last week, honesty to identify the problem is the first step, but also honesty to deal with the problem. And if I'm honest with myself, I'll ask myself, what are the places, who are the people, and what are the pieces common to this temptation, to this struggle? The places, the people, and the pieces in my life that are contributing to this problem that I have, that when I mess up, all or several of these are involved every single time. And then deal with it. Ask yourself, what is it going to take? If it's getting rid of the computer, if it's getting another phone, if it's getting another group of friends, if it's finding another job. I know these are hard things to do, right? Life-changing in some ways. Financially costly in others. But how bad do you want it? That's the real question. How bad do you want it? If you know it and avoid it, sin has less of a chance of taking over. And you know what the reality is? Can you go back to the PowerPoint? I'm going to get distracted by a sunflower. The reality is that fighting temptation is hard work. It's long. It's exhausting. It's tiring. Because you know why? It didn't happen overnight. Most of the time, the things that you and I struggle with that become problems enough that they start causing issues in our life did not happen in a day, in a week, in a month. They happened over a period of weeks, months, years maybe. Of slow steps. We talked about it last week. Slow steps that gradually, at some point, I find myself that I've walked so far away. And you know what that also means is that I'm not going to be able to deal with it in a day, in a week, in a month. It might take months of my time. It might take years of my life. It might take a lot of long, sweaty hours trying to deal with this. sweat-filled, trying to struggle against this. Why is it so hard? Because we've spent so much time with it that it's not going to simply just go away. But you know what? The results are worth it. The freedom that you can have on the other side of whatever it is. In a few years, in a few months maybe, when you can look at that sin, that temptation, whatever it is, in the rearview mirror and say, you know what, that's a part of my past. When you can stand up and you can talk about it now in the past tense, is exhilarating. It's a freedom like you've never known before. You know, Josh sang, we sang In Christ Alone. And I love that song. And as he stands in victory, since curse has lost its grip on me, when you can look at your sin, you look at your temptation and say, you know what? I don't struggle like that anymore. Now, it may never be that you completely let go of that temptation, because sometimes the reality is some temptation in our life will be with us for life. Like Jesus told Peter, sin is crouching at your door and it wishes to have you. Sometimes those things are always in at our back. But there is victory. Just because it will always be a temptation with you doesn't mean it always has to be a problem for you. Jesus came to die to give us victory in this life and in the life to come. Anything less is a joke. So this morning, not only do you know it, but how are you avoiding it? And what steps is it going to take in your life to get rid of it? And are you willing to get rid of it? In a moment, we're going to sing another song. Josh is going to come up and lead us. And as always, we offer an invitation. If you need to respond in any way, we'd be happy to pray for you, to help you struggle in your fight against sin and temptation. Or for any other reasons, perhaps you need the prayers of the church this morning, we'd be happy to help you. And so we invite you to come as we stand and sing.